Welcome to Silicon Subcontinent. Today, we have the honor of having with us Meeta Sengupta, a writer, speaker, and an expert in educational policy and strategy. She has helped organizations like the London Business School and the Commonwealth Business Council create effective education systems while managing to write short stories for children in her spare time. Meeta, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with both of you.
Tell us a little bit about your background. So what was your path like to working in educational policy? Were there any specific events that led you to this field?
So I started off as a banker and as an investment banker. And those were the early heady days of liberalization in India. And I was sent to New York to train with JP Morgan because that was our venture partner at that time. And I trained in debt finance and debt trading, in fact. We came back to India and we realized that debt trading was really not happening. Two mega deals a week between LIC, SBI, SBI, whatever, you know, just two big institutions. And a lot of the informal market. So obviously, we knew that the government of Goisex market, etc., the other debt instruments existed, but the secondary market for them, the trading for them wasn't happening. And that was our job as salespeople, right? To create the hustle, to create the action. Now, in doing that, obviously, you had to discover new markets. And one of the new markets that I discovered, I mean, I was allocated foreign banks, and foreign banks are like 10 banks in the 90s, just 10 of them. That's a very small market. So I went in and spoke to regional rural banks, and they had just been given the chance to run their own treasuries, which means the money that they hold with them. When you lend it out to other banks overnight and so on and so forth, manage your own money, the spare flush money that you have. Before that, it used to be managed by their mentor banks, public sector banks. And these people were having great fun, but they were dealing in debt as if it was equity. You know, so you buy for 30 and you want to sell for 40 kind of stuff. That doesn't happen in debt. It's like it's in paisa, literally. You know, you're trading in interest rates. You're trading in basis points. So in rupee terms, it translates to 10 paisa, 20 paisa, 30 paisa. You cannot, which we basically meant they had no understanding of bond math. They had not been trained in bond math while they'd been given the freedom to deal in something that is literally mathematics. Right. I took a year, I just spoke to my bank, ICICI Bank, and they're always wonderful. I mean, ICICI has been a wonderful organization in terms of recognizing the greater good. And I said, we can't let them be conned by us and by others. I mean, they were not being conned by us, but they were definitely being conned by other brokers. And so I spoke to NABARD, I spoke to the Bankers Institute of Rural Development in Lucknow, and we organized a series of sessions for all the chairmen. So in about four or five sessions over the year, trained these chairmen of the regional rural banks in bond math. And these are super bright people, right? Once they have the math, they went and beat every broker in town. And as a teacher, as a trainer, that was just so satisfying for me. I mean, 1 week spent with 30 of them at a time at that institute, training them four times a year, and you transform the market. That is tasting blood, man, when you know you can go out there and change entire sectors. You know, that means the farmer out there is actually getting a better bank for their savings because their banker is managing their funds better. That's genuine impact just because I knew some little bit of mathematics applied in a specific way. So what you can do with whatever little you have, I had to be in education after that. Stayed in banking, stayed in economic macroeconomic forecasting for a while. Also to learn many more skills. There's a lot of learning before you can give, but definitely knew that I would get back to education sometime or the other.
Are you still connected with that side of yours, that history of yours, which is more, you know, ingrained in finance and perhaps financial education?
Well, yes and no, because I occasionally teach MBA students and I definitely teach MBA faculty because I'm a case study evangelist. I do think that especially in the Indian context, if you do not go via the case study route to learning, you get trapped in textbook learning. So the only way to pull professors out of that textbook mode is to say, here's a case study, because that's when real life examples and contemporary discussions come into the classroom. I mean, not just because it's a great story, but because that's the only way to make it contemporary. So I do. So when I teach negotiations, a lot of negotiation is literally about the finance of what's happening, and so on and so forth. So yeah, a little bit. I do not trade anymore. I think I'm not allowed to because of the contracts I have. See, when you have access to information, you're not allowed to trade that, obviously.
Right. Definitely.
So I don't trade at all.
That would be insider trading.
I mean, I don't even have that much access to information, but still. It's a great proposition to say, I have great access to information. I just like to be cautious, yeah.
Is textbook learning, you mentioned, that you teach today, especially to MBA faculty in India, perhaps more. And you mentioned that's because if you don't do case study teaching or studying using case studies, they fall into the trap of textbook teaching. Are case studies not an integral part of textbooks in India? Is that something that has been lacking a lot, even today?
So what I said was, I believe that firstly, it's always a hypothesis. I mean, you introduced me as an expert. That was very kind of you. In education, there are no experts. It just moves so fast. It's so diverse. It's so complex. Nobody should ever claim expertise in that. But yes, we do have our theories of change. I hate the term theories of change, but we all of us have our theories of what will work. And I believe that case studies are one way of encouraging the professor to allow the students or enable the students to bring in contemporary discussions. So as a toolkit, it works. Whether it comes in a text, whether it comes printed, whether it is purchased from Harvard or wherever it is purchased from, that's just the publisher. That it doesn't matter who the publisher is. Whether it's been written by the professor and is a work in progress, I mean, that's even more fascinating because the class is even more alive with real life discussions. And especially when the students are in their early, mid-20s, almost 30s, they actually know a lot about the business world. So that's a very rich classroom. That's a very rich learning experience, which doesn't happen if you're, say, for example, talking about the theory of negotiations or the micropraxis of alienation. That's a code word. One specific batch, this goes out to my batch.
Hopefully they're paying attention right now.
Well, I'll tell them to.
So this kind of discussion, we're going to circle back to this in terms of how or what changes you think might be helpful in educational practice.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of want to go back to your transition between finance and education. So what were some of the first roles you were in or some of the first tasks you were involved with as a policymaker in education?
Again, policymaker is a very grand term because policymaker is a very establishmentarian term.
Right.
And I see myself as one of your West Coast people, in a way, the spirit of rebellion, the spirit of pioneering. And I refer to the West Coast because that's where you differ from the establishment in many ways, because you want to go out there and create your own. And when I moved back to India, I mean, I'd been teaching for the longest time, actually, in London. London Business School, Economic Intelligence Unit. So there was stuff I knew. There was stuff I was communicating. We were building the Aditya V. Birla Center at the London Business School, which later on became the ISB. So the pilot program for the ISB Hyderabad was this small program that we were running out of London.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I know, awesome times, right? Post-liberalization, the 90s were great. They were great. Unfortunately, and you should ask me a question about this later on, what happened to the greats of the 90s? and why that spirit of transformation doesn't seem to be here anymore. But to come back to your question, the sheer transformation you could create, I brought that back to India, and I realized that the education policy discussion in India is actually very establishmentarian.
Okay.
And so there were no roles as such. There were two or three organizations. So I could either join, say, Pratham, which was doing fantastic work with Asar, or I could join, and this continues to be a problem in education policy conversations, or you could join some sort of a university, which means do your hard yards and write a few papers, etc., and join that kind of a track. But there were these very traditional tracks. The policy track existed only in one or two organizations. I'm reasonably well connected, but I have a horror of nepotism. So because I knew uncles and aunties in those organizations, I didn't even approach them. Just, I mean, I want to be known for what I do, not for whom I know. Mm-hmm. That was important to me. I was young and foolish at that time. So it was important to me to say that I've done it on my own, you know? And maybe that's not necessary. I think all of us should reflect on whether what's necessary or not over there. But that's who I was. And so I started my own organization where, and my entire cause, in fact, was the democratization of education discussion, of education policy discussion. Now, this was early, let's say 2009, 2010. And that was a time when hashtag EduIn on Twitter, which ran into, at one point of time, had a reach of 15 million, 11 to 15 million at a time, according to whatever metrics they were able to pull out at that time. You know, I just go out there and do that. I didn't own the metrics over there. But that property wasn't considered an institution at that time. In this day and age of startups, you'd say, okay, I am doing a startup that is hashtag EduIn. That brings this conversation together. Can I get funding for this conversation? And then you'd monetize it in different ways.
Yeah.
2010, that world didn't exist. So we were pioneering the properties without monetizing the properties. Is that a role? I do not know. School safety, for example. You know, so we sort of, I sort of got trapped in a way between the old world and the new world. And I'm not sure whether it's a trap or it's a natural part of any sectoral development. It doesn't really matter. I mean, there is a journey for every business. Startups also had their own journey. Venture capital had its own journey. So education policy has had its own journey. Now you have about, I think, 15 organizations in education policy. You have at least 200 or 300 edutech startups with different roles for people to start off in education, whether it is on the design side, whether it is impacting policy, whether it is gathering data, whether it is understanding your market. I mean, you actually have a market now. So at that time, I had to grow my, I mean, I looked around and said, who's my competition? And there was no competition. I had to grow my own competition. And so when you grow your own competition, you realize that they've been your students. Now, you don't really compete with your students, do you? Because
you tell us.
You help them grow. You help them grow their stuff, and you give them the boost. So in when you ask the question role, I personally find the word role very tricky, but it is very relevant to today's world, the word role. And there are many fantastic roles in education policy now, within the establishment and outside the establishment.
Yeah, that's an incredibly nuanced picture that you've painted for us in the education landscape over the past few years and perhaps even more than a decade. I wonder though, so you mentioned a bit about edtech startups and you mentioned that there's so many edtech startups now. Do you think they've got the formula to do what's right by the students?
Nope.
Why is that? I want to situate this question and actually particularly to there were reports of for example some edtech startups using predatory tactics to get students on board, perhaps, you know, coerce parents into paying more and enrolling their students. I want to situate this question in that context and ask you, like, what do you think about those reports, and what do you think are edtech startups getting right today and perhaps, in your own words, wrong today?
What they're getting right today, especially the ones who are already established, is they figured out that they were not answering the right questions. And that's wonderful, because now they are strong. They have information. They understand the market. They understand the how to scale, how to deliver. They have their pathways sorted out. They know, for example, they know how to create an app. Instructional design has a massive market. You can access instructional designers, not easily, but definitely can. And you can set up an entire factory of instructional designers. So all of those Lego bits of delivering good quality education technology, all of those arenas have been developed. And they needed to be funded. So I will not blame EdTech pioneers again. I will use the word pioneer again for seeking money first. Because without that, they would not have been able to do what they did. Why they had to go that way, even if they started with very lofty notions, is again because they had to be funded. And if you're funded by a VC, the VC is not in the job, is not in the business of education. The VC is in the business of money.
Right.
You can't expect them to change some business because you're in another business. It doesn't work that way. They're in the business of making money. You have to, if you're taking money from them, you have to deliver that scale, growth, return, valuation, and exit. There is no other way. So you have to play that game. Now, is that the right game to play? Are predatory tactics ideal? Absolutely not. Playing and preying on your customers' fears, insecurities, is never right. But then, is it or was it very, very different from what some grand tuition houses had been doing? If you do not study here, you will not get into IIT. I mean, they never explicitly said that, but those fears were always there, and those fears always created a market, right? You've got to get into that particular JEE training system, and you take exams to get into the training houses, right?
Guilty.
or what's morally right about the entire quota system, the way things operate over there? Or many of the second tier engineering schools where everything is literally, again, textbook rote, etc. There's very little space to grow other than the very specific pathway you've taken. I've had conversations with some students over there who haven't actually been able to read a newspaper for 3 weeks because the newspaper is not relevant to the exams they take, right? So they're not actually aware of what they do, but they're engineering students. Now, is that a moral way to live? Is that how you educate? How you extract value? How you build good citizenry? No. But is it teaching to the task? Is it doing what your money has been spent to do? Yes, it is. It's a very limited way of living. So that's what EduTech has, unfortunately, has had to focus on the money. Fortunately, has realized that focusing only on the money is not doing what they wanted to do when they started off. And they haven't got there. But what we don't have yet, and this is philosophical, so pardon me for going philosophical for a little bit. What we have yet is the toolkit, the processing toolkit for a VC to say, or a filter for selecting somebody to say, this goes out to the greater good. Therefore, I can add some valuation to the greater good. The valuation for the greater good does not get added to the NPV calculations or the IRR calculations or the return calculations or the projections or the pitch. So it will be part of the pitch, of course, but it's not part of the valuation. Until we find that mathematical financial toolkit that adds to the valuation, which, by the way, existed in the 70s and 80s in World Bank records, etc. So there is a history of the math available for that. But it just doesn't feel relevant enough today. But till we get the valuation element in, until that makes sense to VCs and to all participants, till then we won't be able to serve the real purpose of growing our students via EduTech. Well, the potential is immense. Being able to reach girls who are not allowed to get out of their home via mobile phone devices, remote areas. There's just amazing stuff you can do with technology. Just in terms of technology administration, you can just completely create autodidactic pedagogical systems. Pedagogical basically means learning on your own, self-directed learning. There's just so much you can do with technology, but we're not exploiting the potential of technology at all.
Okay. Is this a problem, do you think, that VCs or even businesses can solve? This seems like a very systemic problem where it's not just the establishment, like colleges, for example, that aren't doing right by the students. It's sort of, it's fed to us from sort of day one of education that, okay, this you don't learn or you don't do what you want to do. You do this because you're supposed to do this. I can speak this as an engineer or someone who studied science in 11th and 12th. Instead of working on cool projects in the science lab, as one of our previous podcast guests did during his time spent homeschooling, at least I had to subscribe to the syllabus that CBSE provided us. So is it on the government to come up with new innovative educational solutions, or do you think businesses can take the mantle?
There's a third sector as well, the NGO sector, the non-government sector. And so much innovation in education and in other areas has come from the non-governmental sector. And this is all, and also the private sector. Again, private schools have innovated in amazing ways. I mean, all the way from the Jiddukis to Krishnamurti schools, the Rishi Valleys of the world, etc. That was great innovation. That could not have happened in the government sector, because the government sector is charged with universal, the ask is different, right? The government has to universalize education. Education as a public good has to be delivered. You have to make sure it reaches every child. So their targets are different. Their targets are not innovation. Their targets are literally throughput. They've been asked to make sure that everybody gets the 3 R's in place, the foundational skills in place. Keep the machine moving and process every batch. Now, when it comes to the CBSE, when it comes to textbooks, so this is the third part of what I'm saying. One was innovation in the third sector, amazing work. Innovation in the private schools, amazing work happening. Oh, much of it scalable, much of it not scalable. The third part of it is your CBSE and your textbooks. Now, your textbooks are essentially meant to be a launching pad. They are not meant to be the entirety of your knowledge. They represent a ring fence around knowledge that will be examined. But who tells you to stop yourself at what will be examined? There's no reason to limit yourself to what will be examined, is there? You have the internet, you have libraries, you have resources. In a way, this is not, I mean, you're again a West Coast college, you're a fairly left-wing college, university. So you should point out to me that I'm speaking of privilege. I am speaking of privilege. But if you have the privilege to go beyond your text, then what stops you from doing that? The common friend who introduced you to me in the middle of his class 12th exams was hosting a four-day, this is in the middle of the timetable, was hosting a four-day workshop for younger students in my office, right here, in the middle of exams.
Are the incentives aligned in the education system? Is it the incentives that need to change?
You're right. The incentives are not aligned, and that's where the new education policy comes in, and we are very optimistic about it. But again, optimism has you know, is held together with little strings of hope, kind of thing. So what they're trying to do now is they've completely recognized that the way we learn, especially in India, and it's true for every country. I mean, America has had this teaching to the test kind of teacher scandals. The UK has had 2 to 3 years of pandemic debate about how do we evaluate students if we can't hold a mass exam. So this high-stakes testing that happens in class 10 and 12 or at the O-levels and the A-levels or whatever the new name is. I mean, across 30, 50 years, the names keep changing, the exams remain the same. Always tests mainly for knowledge and always remains high stakes because that's the barrier you cross and that's the filter. It's meant to be a filter exam. It's a funnel, right? You either make it through the funnel or you don't make it through the funnel. So you've got to maximize your value. You've got to maximize your ability to push through the funnel. There is no running away from that. Yeah. That's reality because there won't be enough jobs at the other end or there won't be enough elite institutions at the other end to fit everybody. So one, it is a capacity issue. It's, What if in our beautiful dream world, in our utopian world, we had enough opportunities for everybody? And it didn't need to be a funnel. It could just be a simple pipeline with choices all along those pathways. It could be, I wish it could. The new education policy is trying to do that in India. And what it has recognized in India is that because rote learning has become, has made all of our learning very reductionist, they're going to change the exam. They're going to change the question. So like in America or in Singapore, the question is very, in America, it tests for application. In Singapore, it tests for mastery. Now, in education terms, these mean different things. But basically, you need to know a lot more than just rattebaz. You can't be a mere photocopier anymore. So starting, I think, about 2 years from now, because you need to sort of train up the teachers in how to teach for this also. But the process has already started. The nature of the question is going to change. The National Testing Agency, an institution, has come in. They're going to completely redesign the assessment framework. Because we know whatever happens, it's because of whatever our teaching and learning is going to be framed on the basis of the exam pattern. You can't keep on telling teachers to change and not change the exam pattern. It's the incentives, as you rightly said. So they said, change the incentives. And they are working on that. And I have every respect for that attempt.
Right.
I have not much faith.
I wanted to ask that later on, but
yeah, because you know, there's this amazing thing that happened just yesterday or day before yesterday. They made an announcement in India saying that physics and mathematics is not going to be essential for your engineering entrance. And exactly. Go on, tell me your reaction to that. Let's do that live.
I don't think that's possible if anyone's attempting to be a serious engineer at any point down the line.
For me, I don't even think it's why is that happen? I'm curious to know why that was a consideration and why it was proposed slash perhaps approved.
So then so the way I see it is, for example, in the US, if in 11th or 12th or whatever it you're, what do they call their 11th and 12th?
Junior, senior.
High school, right?
Junior and senior year.
So in that, suppose you have not taken higher order math and you come into your university and you say, I really don't know this as well as I should. What happens? Somebody comes up to help you. You have a study group that's available to you.
Yeah.
You have resources available to you. You have your lower level courses that are essential to take before you move on to your higher order courses.
Yeah.
So there is a system in place, right? If you're not prepared for something, there is a system in place to make sure that you're up to the level. So why they've tried to do this in India as a policy is because they say that suppose you made the mistake of not taking science in class 11 and 12. Really, class 9 and 12, 10, what do you even know about what you
like? That's true.
To be able to trapped into the choice. Suppose you forgot, you didn't take physics at that time and you took psychology. And you're actually really, really good at physics. But you discovered that only when you sat with your friends. And you were able to crack their physics textbook much better than they were able to. Why should that student or that wonderful batch of students, group of students, be trapped just because of some early choices they made? You should be able to explore psychology and say, no, actually, I'm really made for physics. But that is not going to work. So the idea is to reduce the access barrier only at the entry point. But it's not going to work if you don't have the other supporting structures in place. So you remember the regional rural bank? They said you can manage your own money, but they didn't put in the training. You're messed up totally, man, if you don't put in the training. So here again, it's going to be awful if they do not put in the support structures. But fine, we let you in, but we're not going to let you progress till you know your stuff.
Yeah.
Certification and the competence do not need to be linked to each other. You can de-link them. But the competence must exist. I agree with you. I mean, engineers in India were up in arms. Scientists were up in arms, outraged.
I want to double click on that point because I think that's particularly relevant in the context of this podcast, specifically where we talk about engineering talent in India and how that has given rise to so many startups. I think one of the good things about, and perhaps this is something that people don't realize early on, is yes, there is a lot of rote learning in our system, and yes, students are forced to make some early choices. But I think that, would you agree with this? I guess this is a question to you, Amita. Would you agree with this statement that there has existed this talent arbitrage between India and some of the Western nations in terms of students going to foreign universities and excelling because they know so many of the concepts that have already been taught to them in high school? So, for example, this is just an anecdote, and maybe Aman can attest to this as well, but when I came to Rice, I found that some of the courses that I had to take, I could do really well in them, only because I had those foundations and those skills already developed in 11th and 12th grade. So when you say that physics and chemistry or math, or physics and math, is not required for engineering, do you think we would lose some of that talent arbitrage as well?
You know, that's exactly the most wonderful argument that another engineer presented to me yesterday. And I've asked her to write a newspaper article exactly on this, because that was the strongest argument I have heard, and you presented it very well, against this new policy. And I think you're absolutely right, because the math, physics, STEM, and then engineering pathway was one of the few pathways where we were able to attain and sustain rigor in our learning. We were able to, and again, when we go back, by the way, none of us is against rote learning. Rote learning is different from reductionist learning. Being a photocopier is what I object to. Reductionism is what I would object to. Rote has amazing uses. I mean, you want your surgeon to know what to plug into you in the middle of surgery, man. And he has to do that from memory. More importantly, when you're terribly depressed or you're having one of those rough moments in life, just being able to remember some poetry that works for that moment, that's a great internal resource. All poetry is written in angst. Much of it is written in angst. And that depends upon memory as a skill. That depends upon rote. You have to learn poems by rote. I mean, there's a Ghalib quote for everything. There's a Shakespeare quote for anything. And for the Bengalis out there, there's a Shonar Kella quote. That's a movie. For every situation in life. For Amitabh Bachchan fans, there's an Amitabh Bachchan quote for everything. And so, that's memory, right? And it helps you in so many different situations. To come back to the more rigorous thing, yes. The two questions come from what you say, actually. One, yes, of course, there was knowledge arbitrage, which was based on this rigor and this very deep, sustainable, very well done set of competencies that were drilled into our students. The second question that comes from that is that arbitrage good for India? And I'm not going to answer that, but I think that question needs to be placed on the table. Yeah. Whether it should have been arbitrage or whether it should have had opportunities without having to give the advantage of that arbitrage. I mean, arbitrage effectively is a no-cost deal, right? So should we have been handing that no-cost deal out to everybody? It's a sad loss, and it's a sad loss at the policymaking level.
That's very insightful.
You guys will come back, so we'll be fine.
It's funny how our discussions are, I don't want to say taking a tangential turn, but I think we always come back to these philosophical questions. I don't know if this is about education in general, but it's such a, I think especially for India, it's such a sensitive topic, because we pride ourselves on our education, but there's also these glaring holes that everyone seems to be aware of. But like you said, we can be optimistic, but it's all tied up by these little strings of hope. So yes, it is what it is.
Yeah, but as Siddhartha said, this is about incentives. And the way we run it right now, the incentives are perfectly aligned. It's a neat, efficient system. There's no doubt about that.
I want to take a turn here, and I'd love to sort of circle back on this topic. We're going to talk a little bit about entrepreneurship in India, and specifically how education shapes entrepreneurship in India. So, of course, first of all, would you agree that the Indian education system has historically placed an emphasis on getting your run-of-the-mill 9-to-5 job that pays well, perhaps a government job? Do you think that's what the education system has promoted, at least historically?
When you use the word promoted, I would have to agree with you. Whether they've successfully done that, I'm not quite sure. I mean, traditionally, we used to have two types of families in classrooms, right? We had the service families, and then we had business families. And often, it was in my generation, it was highly correlated. In your generation, it's probably much less correlated. The business families did not expect their students to get high marks. They did not expect them to compete for that funnel. And often we used to think it was because they had the money. But really, it was because they were building other capacities as well. They were building capacities for relationship building. They were building capacities for sale, for managing partnerships. They were building capacities for risk taking. I mean, it is a risk, right? When you say, I'm not going to try to be the topper in the class.
Yeah,
that's a risky position to take. And what is business? By definition, it is the taking on of risk for returns. Right?
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. The Indian system did not promote it, but it did not disable it either. You had another part to this question, which I haven't answered. Could you ask that again?
Yeah. So you mentioned that, of course, Indian education system has not promoted risk taking. How does that conservatism sort of manifest itself right now? Where are those spaces that you see that, of course, there's this divide between families who attend normal education, and there's that background that plays into the conservatism and risk taking. But is there some? What are those spaces in education itself that sort of promotes that, hey, like, you should be more conservative towards, you know, you can't just go and start a business, you can't just go and solve a problem? Where is this happening?
You know where it's happening? Tier 2 engineering schools. 45 to 54-ish is the number I remember. I went into some schools, engineering schools, on the outskirts of Jaipur, some in Maharashtra somewhere. And then I spoke to some faculty I was training, and they're saying, at least a third, maybe even a half of our students want to run startups.
Wow.
It's amazing. The entrepreneurial energy in India is amazing. So to answer the first part of your question, what was the path in the traditional system towards entrepreneurship? It was through disappointment, failure, angst, hurt, a lot of misery, 2 or 3 years of everybody saying, Sharma ji ka beta. And what is your son doing? Because it doesn't seem to have a role. You see, the need for role as identity is critical. You know, you have a job role, you have a job title, you have a business card. At one stage, you have a provident fund account from a generation ago. That seemed to be important because economic stability is what we want for our children. I mean, that's finally when the parents can get rid of all that they're carrying on their shoulders. It's anxiety for parents, right? Till their children are economically independent. So the faster you get them into economic independence, what's the word they use? Settle. Mm-hmm. Child gets settled. Yeah. That's literally saying that you are economically viable. It's the, pardon my French, FO money. Till you have your FO money, we cannot rest as parents and as teachers. And our job is to make sure that you get to that stability as fast as you can so that you can begin to make your choices from a position of security rather than insecurity. So that is what the Indian education system was geared to, towards bringing you to economic stability. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it maximizes your potential. It doesn't. It doesn't mean that it gives you a path to where entrepreneur, as an entrepreneur, you can be an entrepreneur in a startup, or you can be an entrepreneur in a larger organization, right? Yeah. So where you're picking up entrepreneurial skills in a consulting organization as well, where you say, I will go out and create this new market. Of course, you have to prove your skills before that. You could do the hard yards before that, saying, I can be trusted with your money and your brand. You can't put a large brand at risk just because you don't know what you're doing. So you have to do you have to prove yourself in that. And that's a whole other learning and proving yourself and competence versus certification journey. Sure. The startup thing is you're proving it only to yourself. Again, those avenues exist, but they have been deprioritized in the quest for security. And once you are able to, I think it's up to you as a generation, actually, to force, and you are the watershed generation, to say, and many of your near seniors, the past 10 years, and many of you right now, are showing the system that it is possible to create stable growth pathways, even if you venture out on your own through entrepreneurship. This is why, again, these engineering colleges were thrilled to say that about half of our students want to be entrepreneurs. That was a matter of pride for them. Now, that's a change. That's a transition. Yeah. The Sharma ji ka beta is seen as a very conventional person. My kids doing a startup, that's already an emotional transition. That automatically then translates into higher education, college, university, engineering school, but it does not go all the way down to school. I have to admit that it doesn't go all the way down to school. And maybe it shouldn't, right? Because at school, you're still picking up so many foundational skills. You do need that rigor. I mean, you yourself said that rigor gave you that boost.
Yeah. Having that background, like Shreyans said, having that background, that rigor we went through in school definitely gave us a leg up when we came to college. Can't speak for Indian colleges because we haven't been to any, but it definitely was a boost, at least for us studying in the US.
Coming back to the point of incentives aligning in the education system, do you think India is at a point where our educational incentives should even promote risk-taking and entrepreneurship, given that almost 70% of India's population is still below the poverty line? Like, is it even morally right to pursue this path? Because the fact is that despite the standardized education curriculum in place, India has succeeded in building this beautiful machine that produces engineers and professionals every year who are doing great things. We've launched a rocket to Mars that cost less than a big budget Hollywood movie. And like you said previously, students in colleges are already leading towards entrepreneurship in big numbers, despite the current incentives.
That's where the demographic dividend, of course, kicks in, because we have enough and more engineers to do this and that. So that's the good thing. There is certainly definitely a lot to be said about the rigor and, in a way, the humility of Indian engineering students. You know, the engineering people you meet at an ISRO or whatever, there is a certain willingness to do the junior levels rather than rise to be CEO within 2 or 3 years. And the startup world is a very impatient world. Is it morally right to do that? Absolutely morally right to go into the entrepreneurship and startup world, because the startup world is the world of value addition, of moving up the value chain, and is in the business of creating jobs. What India needs at this point of time is job creators. So for with a slight economist hat on, I would say when we look at the multiplier effect of money, I would want to see the multiplier effect of jobs. As a VC, for example, I would love to, or if there was a government sovereign fund out there, they should be funding things that they should be funding job creators for the number of jobs they create. Because that's the imperative right now. That's what eases the educational funnel as well, right? That's what makes it easier for the students in class 10 and 12. So yes, it is morally absolutely right to create an entrepreneur. There is another reason, but you'll find that slightly tangential. So I will lay off on that. But it is also, I think, important to create disruption to be able to leapfrog. We have this amazing opportunity. Because again, the minute your batch, for example, comes back to India, you're bringing with you leapfrogging opportunities.
Okay. What do you mean? Could you please expand on that? What do you mean by the disruption?
So what is innovation by definition, right? Startups tend to build on innovation. And innovation is a disruption in the system. And innovation is a disruptor. In fact, in San Francisco, I saw a billboard that said out-disrupt. And this out-disrupt was, I swear, the most San Francisco thing I have ever seen. Like, out, what does it even mean? And that's literally it, right? Why would you create disruption? Because the standard pathway, even towards the economic stability that we were talking about earlier, this is just the economics of the innovation that you create, the economics of the engineering that you created, or whatever solution you create. The economics of the solution says that even if you were to go down that stable path of jobs, etc., you would be working on a certain trajectory. The only way to move beyond this sort of semi-flat trajectory into a much faster growth trajectory, both as individuals and as an aggregated economy, is to create some sort of a disruption there where you can leap to the higher level.
Okay.
Right? So your startup isn't for the sake of innovation. You're not innovating for the sake of innovation. You're not disrupting for the sake of disruption. You're not disrupting for the sake of glorifying yourself as a CEO or a boss man. You are innovating and you are going down this entrepreneurship path for the sake of creating value and scaling up that value addition. What you do with that value addition is the difference between, let's say, an Amazon or a Salesforce, maybe.
Right. I like that bent. This relates to something that I was looking at. I think a week ago it was. I don't know if you know Chamath Palihapitiya. I think that's his name. Sorry if I mispronounced that. He talked about how entrepreneurship is. It allows individuals to be wealth creators, rather than be a part of labor. Mm-hmm. If you do a job that is that you are contributing to labor, but when you become an entrepreneur, you are creating wealth, not just for yourself, but you know, for people around you and for everyone else, and of course for yourself as well.
Absolutely, well, very well said. One of my professors said that there are no new ideas in the world. So what Chamath said literally translates into the four factors of production: land, labor, capital, and enterprise, and how you combine them to again create value added. Literally, it is again about creating wealth, because wealth is the way you create greater value add. You compound value addition in a way. You bring that I called it the multiplier effect, which is a much simpler concept. Compounding, of course, takes it up. You right. Choose your exposure.
That's a good tagline.
One of those sound bites, right? You choose your exponent.
It's the title of this episode.
Yep, definitely. Something that I wanted to actually ask is, you talked about disruption and you sort of alluded to the S-curve of disruption, which is how companies shift from one S-curve to the other, and that is what actually constitutes disruption. I want to use that and ask you this. Are there any spaces in the education industry where you see disruption happening, and particularly by private companies? And what are those niche spaces that you think in the next 5 to 10 years will become huge markets?
Yeah, there's tons, and you should actually do an ed tech episode with somebody who works directly in it. We'll find people for you, because I can again answer it from the sort of policy philosophy perspective, and a lot of the changes that I'm advising then become confidential. But you're right about that. There's an immense amount of disruption ahead. There's the disruption has been held back so far only because of the whole money angle. But for example, And I swear your batchmates are going to say that's not what AI means. But everybody in AI, everybody in education now pretends to be an AI shop, for example. Now, that's really interesting, right? Then the morality question comes into it. If you know your student and the student progress from nursery all the way to higher education or even for lifelong learning, of course, you can create a lot of scaffolding around the student building because you have predictive technologies, right? You have predictive technologies that say that this is the way the student should be behaving for progress, or this is the natural way the student behaves, or this is the mental wellness ranking of the student or rating of the student. I mean, moving from those the marks that we used to get in exams, we're now going to move to mental wellness marks. I mean, that's too much pressure for any student.
That's actually happening?
That's actually pretty much happening. A state government has actually announced that we're going to introduce AI into managing our students' progress. Okay. So that's actually been adopted by the establishment. A lot of people think it's a very good idea. I have serious concerns about privacy. I have serious concerns about self-efficacy. I have serious concerns about free will as well, but we'll not go down the free will pathway. Well, I honestly, as a student, I would not want to be monitored for my bad moods. I am entitled to my bad moods. And I will fight my way through them because that's the way we learn how to fight, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to be supported and scaffolded. My job as a student is to learn how to fight those miserable moments. Whether you got bad marks in your exam and somebody said, why did you get 9 out of 10? Why did you not get 10 out of 10? I mean, losing that one mark is misery. I say that as somebody who got 98 out of 100 in my class 10 board exams. I will never forget that misery or the shame of that, you know. I will never forget that, but I will also never allow that to happen again. And it's those moments that I don't want to be that scaffolded. So AI, for example, is building a huge amount of change. AI tracks, for example, let's talk about Pearson's wonderful product, actually. They have this JEE preparation thing, right? They've gone retail now. And that tracks a lot of your performance along strands. Using machine learning and AI, they say, I don't really know why it needs AI as such, or whether that's a pitch. But that's a great product that helps you track your performance and again move up the learning value chain. So yeah, you are saying that's not really AI, aren't you? I'm only telling you what I've been told in their presentation. So there's a lot of simple stuff like that that's happening. And I will call this simple because it's about tracking. It's more administrative as such. There's a lot of wonderful stuff happening in the neurosciences. So you have biohacking that's quite mainstream right now for health. You will have biohacking for learning very, very soon. So not just devices embedded in your body to track how much you've learned and what you've changed. We know so much more about the way our brain responds to different ways of learning, response to stimuli. So we will be able to include a lot of that learning into what we do. So a lot of it actually translates all the way down to teacher training. And what you see, what your teachers used to call the method in the class, that I have to follow the method.
Yeah.
Or I have to follow the lesson plan. In the classroom, it sounds like a lesson plan. Where it comes from is, say, where it will come from now is through the neurosciences, saying that you will be able to hack memory by doing these 15 things.
Mm.
So you will be able to, in early years, for example, NLP, which is language and hypnotherapy, is used to reduce anxiety in students.
Okay, so by NLP, you're not talking about natural language processing, you're talking about neuro-linguistic programming.
Yeah, they're both called neuro-linguistic programming. The guy just stole the term from computer sciences. This is mumbo-jumbo science, right? Right now. It's mumbo-jumbo science that's actually was hypothesized, was sold a lot. But there's actual science happening. There's lots happening down the road from you at Stanford, for example.
Right.
So there's definitely going to be a lot of that. And all of that will be delivered through your phones. I mean, if you can have an ECG on your smartwatch now, think of what you can do with learning, how much you know about something. What, though, of course, the, the key question still remains, the fundamental question that has never been answered for 200 years, is what is that point at which learning has happened?
What does that mean? So can you expand that question a bit? I'm curious to see. Just what do you mean by the point at which learning happens?
You may want to edit this out of this thing because it'll become less, it's not a very sellable, marketable thing. But at what point of time do you know your alphabet and not know your alphabet? Where's that difference, right? There's a certain point when somebody's sitting next to you and saying A, B, C, D, or teaching you phonics, or teaching you how to build a racket, a squash racket that's behind you, right? So what is that point at which you're saying that I am not and I am? Can you actually literally pinpoint that moment? Is there an SI unit of learning? These things don't exist, right, in education theory and learning theory.
Right.
But once you make it into a neuroscience kind of thing, all of these things will have units of when a person knows this thing and when a person doesn't know this thing, right? Because the way the brain reacts, they have color-based studies that, right? Whether the brain turns yellow or whether it turns red, how it's reacted to the stimulus, how much it has reacted, how much it has retained, how much of that electrical impulse has been triggered. So we're going to get into the science of education now in a way that we got into the science of diagnostics and health between the 60s and 2000. So the science of education, that hacking with actual understanding of what's happening to learning, is only going to start in the next 5 to 10 years. We're at this amazing, and you guys are going to build it, actually. Your generation is going to build it. So we will be able to give you the philosophical questions. We will be able to bring you back to reality in a way, saying, you know, hang on, this is not how it happens for everybody. Or will this work for that child in the village?
Yeah.
We will be able to ask you those questions. But you'll be building these things that you'll be calling hacks at the beginning, but that will eventually become the science of learning, that will eventually become scalable via technology. So when we say a lot of your jobs are going to be done by robots, a lot of the learning process is also going to be done by the technology within us. As an exoskeleton embedded or as a technique, it doesn't matter. I mean, there are three different ways that will happen. But that is the future of education. The classroom itself and the hub and spoke model, it seems, will still remain important. Why? Because of what's going to happen in the next 2 to 5 years, which was your more immediate question. And that's about social and emotional learning. So what we've learned, and this is the more conventional answer, what we've learned about learning is that the moment of learning is literally a social and emotional moment. You remember things for which you have either a social or an emotional memory. You remember moments where you failed. I did not manage to crack that thing in that exam. I'm never going to forget that concept again. You remember things where you won. You remember that moment, that slam dunk in tennis. And that technique, the way you held your hand. Is that a squash racket or a tennis racket behind you? That's a tennis racket. So that moment where you made that slam dunk, you're going to remember the angle of your hand. Because that was an emotional moment of victory. So our memory is triggered by emotional moments, and our memory is sustained, and our learning and application of it is sustained by social moments. And that was proved by the MOOCs. Because when MOOCs were delivered only to individuals, they created absolutely no impact, either learning impact or in terms of progressing the cohort or the individual, until there was a cohort. And then MOOCs started self-organizing into learning groups. Which was all online. Of course, it was all using technology. Some were physical groups, very few of them. But once learning groups happened, once learning became social and there was peer learning and there was engagement over there, that is when MOOCs actually began to deliver value. It was only 5 years after that they could start asking for money for certification, right? Till after they could prove value. Massive example of, I think it's in Peru, in the mountains of Peru, and this lady has been awarded and has been the Minister of Education over there, where peer learning of students in primary schools has been proved to be far more effective. Why? because it creates, and this is a movement now that's across the world, because it creates social and emotional learning moments. And that's when retention application begins to get triggered. That's when creativity and all of your 21st century skills get triggered. You're communicating, you're using critical thinking because you're asking questions. You're able to build an entire holistic skill set if you put right. social and emotional learning rather than rote learning at the center. Again, still a role for rote, no doubt about it, but it's not the center of the conversation. So yes, social and emotional learning is what's going to happen in the near future in EdTech as well.
I think this is key because when I look back at moments where I feel I've either learned something really well or applied something I've recently learned, it's almost always been in these study groups where we're trying to solve this tough problem together, and one or two people, like I'm with one, and it's weird how if the number increases, at least in my case, if it's a lot of people, it doesn't really have the same impact as this sort of tight-knit group where we're all at the same level as far as the subject goes. And so we all bounce ideas off of each other, and when we crack that problem, it's pretty fun. Yeah, that moments, those moments stand out. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, the evidence-based science of that, or the theories of education, continue to evolve, and this is again as these theories evolve, as the evidence gathers. Again, in education, it normally, between evidence and practice in the classroom, it takes about 2.5 to 3 years, not more than that. So agile learning, for example, was a very big deal about 2 years ago. Now come the pandemic, we're talking about hybrid learning, because we're all trying to build hybrid learning toolkits. And that means EduTech again to the center. But this time, with that social and emotional learning, with that perfect group. Again, yeah. How do you identify what that perfect group is? What is the ideal size of that theoretically? What is the leveling off that you are talking about? Yeah. And how do you institutionally or algorithmically actually create that kind of a group? I mean, that's right now in the future of education. But when if you're building it now, you're delivering it in 12 to 18 months time, right?
Yeah. I think algorithms can do a lot better job than, say, an institution or people ever could, at least in terms of matching people. I don't know what you think. This is my opinion.
Like innovation, it can't be an algorithm for algorithm's sake, right? So of course they're useful, but they're only a tool. They're only a tool. The real questions have to come from real moments of value creation. Don't let the algorithm lead you. That would be worse than the exam leading your learning.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind, and I hope our listeners also keep that in mind. So if you were given unlimited funds and unlimited power at this point, what educational policies would you implement specifically in the next, say, 2 to 5 years for maximum impact?
You're going to make me say this. You make me feel like Miss Universe at this moment. If you had all the power in the world. It's one of those last three questions, right? Ask to all contenders. I'm very much an advocate of lifelong learning. I do think that we should have systems that enable lifelong learning in a structured and supported manner through multiple pathways. And I think creating those structures, again, I called it heutagogy earlier, autodidactic learning. It doesn't have to be. So a little bit more than corporate training, definitely different from, or analogous to, but slightly different from or more supported than, say, a computer science person learning a new skill every 3 to 5 years because it becomes redundant. Not just that. So, for example, I have taught in my class, I used to teach Access to Business as well. A 70-year-old professor who retired as a professor of French because he wanted to start a business, and therefore he was in my class to learn business. Now, that's amazing capacity for renewal. So if I had everything possible, so I would be focusing on the policies that build renewal for young, old, anybody. I mean, completely universal the opportunities to renewal would be first on my list.
Well, I'm glad that I'm glad to sort of encapsulate this podcast with this advice from you, which is lifelong learning. I hope that I'm able to keep that up, and I hope that Aman's going to keep that up, and that's implemented soon. I'd love to do that. Thank you so much for being here, Meeta. We loved having you.
Thank you very much for having me.